Yo, check it out. A whole new generation of young people today who belong nowhere.
But I prefer to be now cast.
Third culture kids where the content of the Dukan is the corner shop or the top shop.
We are live outside. Hey, yo, what's up, people?
What up, nation?
It's the revolution of expression.
You're tuned in to the Dukan show. Stay tuned in.
Arab digital generation is shaping our identity, their creative expression, and their future. So please give a very warm welcome.
Welcome to your tribe.
All right, y'all. What's happening, everybody? Welcome to this week's episode of the Dukan Show. As always, we got Reamsies in the building.
Auntie Reem to you.
Yes, ma'am.
Reamsies.
Put some respect on her name.
Put some respect on my name.
And I can't, we couldn't be with us today, but we got Nadir. So I don't know. I mean, I don't say we got someone better because like Akawi.
No, I mean,
I love Akawi, but
I mean,
is it somebody else?
I can't.
You know, but we got Nadir in the building straight out the UK. Those dudes showed up at the beginning of summer. Like he is here as the temperatures are rising.
Oh my God. I was really worried that I wouldn't be able to come the whole winter season because this place means a lot to me, man.
Yeah.
Does it?
Yeah. As a convergence point of like friends, but also creatives in the region. And you guys know more than anyone, the winter season is that moment we all kind of come together.
That's
and
stretch.
Lots of programs, events happening in the city.
Yeah.
So the thought of not being able to come was really like jarring on me. And then this last minute opportunity came. And now we're here.
And
we're at the table.
Here he is.
Love it. What brought you out here? Was it work or just…
It was work. It was work. And I will always say yes to anything that brings me out here because like this family and friends that I want to see, of
Love
course.
Love it.
So, and like I said, the city means a lot to me. This crazily misunderstood city.
I think it's terribly misunderstood. I mean, when you're in it, you get it. But then I think one of the things we constantly have to do is sort of come to its defense, with, you know, in the public especially, because people misunderstand. And the question of like, where is the soul of this city? That's the, you know, that's usually where the attention
point.
That's
why we exist.
Yeah, that's why I'm looking forward to actually speaking to you guys actually, because… Who would know more about the pulse of the city than you guys who've invested in it over the last… You told me 2016 this started?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. So you've obviously seen like the genesis from beginning to end.
Oh, I mean, for some of us who grew up here as well…
Yes, exactly.
We've seen that development over time. We've seen the growth and the changes in the city, right?
100%.
But then in terms of documenting it through the show, that we were live first week of January 2016.
Yeah.
And we've been running ever since.
And the culture has shifted and moved in places like we can never imagine since then.
Completely. And it's so much fun because one, we're tapping on our friends' shoulders and like, hey, come on and be part of this.
Yeah.
We, as we progressed, we started to realize like there is more people like us and there's more out there that are doing this in various ways and different styles. And there's so much to be said for it. And then there are times when we just want to shoot the shit. We're like, you know what, let's just catch up.
We sort of grew up on the show now.
Yeah.
Like when you look at… Well, that's what happens when you make art or do culture, like perform culture.
100%.
You document your journey, your life.
But this is why I don't think people understand how important this platform is. This is a chronicle and an archive of the cultural history of the city.
Thank you.
And like this stuff's important. And I think like… I've known about you guys for like a long time coming. And I think there's a lot of transient points that me and you kind of converge on. It's about culture. It's about identity. It's about community. And I think that's why it resonated with me so much. And it became like a big reference for me to learn a lot. So I appreciate you guys.
I appreciate
it. And we appreciate you. So
we're
like…
Big
like,
fans of your work.
I'm like a huge fan. So what is your work? Like how do you define your work? Because I know what you
question,
do, but what is the work?
No, I get asked this question a lot. And I think… I don't know whether it's a good or bad thing. I'm like, am I not being clear enough?
No, you're being very clear, actually.
Because I can tell you what I think it is. And you can correct us. But I think… You know, let people hear from you.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. So like, I've learned to become better at it. You know, like, especially in the creative process, people tell you, Nadir, you need a tagline.
Yeah.
Right? Like the elevator pitch. And I really struggled with that. Why? Because I felt like my multi-hyphenated identity couldn't be summarized in that elevator pitch.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know…
It
like,
can't. That's the truth of it. There's tough. Always something that's going to be marginalized, right?
Yeah.
And then you learn… The tagline is about making that white creative exec at some of the biggest brands understand who you are in a couple sentences.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me a long time, and I've been in this game for maybe 5-6 years, so probably only arrived at that kind of destination now-ish. And I say I'm wannabe Brown Bourdain.
You are wannabe Brown Bourdain. Yes.
I'm here for it. This is why the sound effects are here.
No, that's exactly it, actually. Yeah. Like, that's exactly it.
Yeah, for sure.
But no, I think you, well, the truth of it, now that you said it, it's absolutely correct.
And it's a great elevator pitch.
Yeah, thank you, man. If you don't know who Bourdain is, Bourdain is a cultural culinary icon, food writer, presenter, Adiyat Harm. Like, he basically kind of like laid the foundation of new generation travel culture and etiquette.
Yes.
How do you traverse this world emotionally inquisitive and curious in a way that would connect with people from various different cultures? But he was also morally upright.
So he was noble. Yes. I think there was a nobility to him.
Sure. And despite all that, I admired his... how uncensored he was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. He'll say his piece, good or bad. He was raw at all times. And that's one of the things I love, just simply because, as you know, a lot of these people become more and more famous, or you're across all these different types of media, they all want to control a narrative in a certain way. And he's like, no, no, no. We're doing it this way.
100%.
And I respected him for that. I love that about his work.
So much things about the world. People say, oh, it's complicated.
It is.
It is.
Therefore, we should tackle it.
100%. But there are also some clear situations that I felt that are very clear. And like being unapologetic about what we feel is right and wrong.
Yeah.
He was great at. So like, I'm just trying to traverse the world in a very similar way. Food is a big inspiration behind that. So
absolutely.
Long story short, I travel the world. I meet people, and food is a medium for me to connect with them on a deeper level. But especially people who haven't had the luxury or privilege of having had that story told in a way that's nuanced and emotionally engaging and entertaining. How do we take complex ideas and distill them into really accessible stories and experiences that sheds light on who they are in their greatest quality?
Yeah.
And that's what I try to do my best, learning every day as it comes. And it's taking me in journeys and alleys that I never expected. But a lot of the means I do that is content, experiences, and sometimes products.
Nice.
So yeah, bro.
And are you a storyteller first or a chef first?
I think storyteller. I would no way claim to be that I'm a chef.
Right.
Okay.
Food is a big part of my life. Being a chef is an art. It's something people dedicate their lives to. I am not that person, but I love cooking.
Yeah.
And what I love about our world right now is that we're celebrating people who just love to cook at home. I think that's beautiful as well, because that's so much more accessible than like the Michelin star.
And that journey of like culinary craftsmanship. But at home, there is that adventure. 100%. There is that space to like feed and show love. And in all of our cultures, to sit with someone at their table is their way of saying, I love you, or welcome, or, and all things in between.
Yeah.
So what's your creative process like? Because I must say this, your content is, for me, so refreshing. It was so refreshing to see it on my feed when I first interacted with your work. But then I realized, as you began, I hoped you would stick with it. Because you know, when someone first sort of shoots one out there, you had so much value. Your content is so value-packed. It has on so many layers. You speak about the culture. You speak about the singular dish that you're making.
And the entire
history behind it.
That revolves around it.
I appreciate you. Yeah, like consistency. Thank you for mentioning that, which is I'm notoriously bad at. but I think what happened was this whole TikTok generation was emerging, right?
Yeah.
And it was basically indicative of a whole new era in which social media content was going about. And it makes us as creators constantly having to reinvent or reimagine the ways in which we tell our stories, which is interesting because the algorithm can shape the way in which the story is told, right? And, I started had to figure out, okay, cool, there's this new kind of real kind of 90-second content. How do you tell dense stories in a really concise form?
Right.
And I just didn't find anything. I was never going to be that guy that's like dancing on a TikTok or whatever. That's just not my vibe. Mm-hmm. How do I tell something of substance in 90 seconds? And then it occurred to me, I would cook a dish. And what's amazing about food is like the perfect Trojan horse.
Right, isn't it?
So people, they probably go on their phone, there's no audio. So they don't actually initially hear the story. So they see an amazing dish of food.
Yeah.
And what I used to realize about my work before is that the only people that would like watch my content were people who were maybe of diaspora heritage, Middle Eastern background. And they were able to directly relate to the stories that I would tell. Then I started using food, and then I started to get all these white people following me.
Mm.
And I'm like, ooh. Hello.
Hello.
I'm like, this is crazy. Things are changing.
Yeah,
and like usually
if
a white person was following me, it was like a marketing exec at a brand. Maybe it was like a someone of, you know, it was a work thing.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Someone who probably wanted me to work with them at some point.
Or they were trend spotting or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. There was like a, yeah, exactly. And then, which was hard. And I was like, damn, how do I make my experience more relatable to people who aren't directly part of it? Then I started using food and I started to realize, whoa,
yeah.
Like people who aren't directly relatable to this experience are starting to engage with my content. And food brought them in because they were like, that looks delicious. What I'm going to do is like slide a story in.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what I found was people were so much more amenable to the people and the story that it created an environment where people were relating to each other a lot
more.
And that's the golden thread of a story, right? It's like, how are we drawing on like universal shared human experiences that allows like the Caucasian European to relate with the Black Sudanese, right?
Yeah.
Like how do we create these bridges which creates a more equitable world for everybody? And it banged.
So well,
the format was 90 seconds and it just started hitting. And I was like, damn, like I've struck something. And when you struck something algorithmically, you just got to keep pounding.
You run with it.
What was the moment you realized you struck gold? Like, what was that moment?
When it deeply resonates with people and you see when someone shares something on their platform.
Right.
On mass like that, you start to realize like, okay, cool. Like this is something. It's resonating with people that they're willing to share it on their digital space. And that means a lot to me when someone goes through that process.
Of course.
Because it takes a lot to get someone to share stuff these days, right?
Yeah.
It takes a lot to get anyone to share anything ever since the beginning of time, I think. You know?
100%.
And you have that privilege.
Yeah,
you have that privilege.
It was like,
people do share.
Wow, 100%. Like, thank God for it's resonating on this way. And then I just stuck with it. And I think, you know, any creators out there who are thinking, okay, how do I structure content in a way that's like, doable on a consistent basis. It's all about finding something that's relatively, you can film in a day.
Right.
You don't have to travel across the country to do it. But that I was able to do in my home, in a little vertical space that's this much, cook it in maybe 4 or 5 hours, do the video post,
nice.
And put it out there. And because it was easy to do relatively, 2 days in comparison to some of the stuff I do, which is like 2 months.
Right.
So like it allowed me to be consistent as much as possible.
And is your background in content creation or in filmmaking?
No,
or so like, what,
like no,
so what, how? Because the quality, by the way, are you a one man show? Like, is this all you?
Initially, like definitely in the beginning. But now, you know, alhamdulillah, luckily I'm like, got people to support me.
Great.
And it's got to that destination. But it also depends on the project. So some projects I'll just do as a passion project.
Yeah.
So there's no real support system. I'll edit it myself and I'll do everything my own. So those videos specifically, the ones, the Simmering Memories, the historical recipes, I began doing it myself.
Yeah.
But sometimes I'll do it in collaboration with like a NGO or a humanitarian organization and there is a budget to get an editor, so I'll do that.
Okay, great.
Or I've like made money from other brand projects and then I'll siphon that money into an editor to help me work on that so
right.
I can work on other stuff that I want to do. So it's got to that point, thankfully, but there was a point where I was doing everything.
Like
pre-production, post. And that's a lot. It's a lot of work. And like, I think that level, and you guys know more than anyone, that level of work is so intense.
Yeah.
But you do it for so long, it just becomes normal.
Yeah, it does.
And then you have to zoom out and you have to be like,
is this sustainable? Yeah.
Yeah, but people can't believe you. And like, I don't think I work hard. This is what I was worried about.
this imposter syndrome needs to stop. Oh. It needs to stop.
But people look at your process and they're like, bro, you need to take some time.
You need to
like,
calm down. You need to calm down. No, because the quality, it is the quality, but I think it's not, I don't know if it's, I don't think the in with the amount of content that we consume, it's not about the caliber of the shot. It's not that. It's about the content and the story.
Exactly.
It's that.
Right.
That's 100%. Where I think you really hit heavy.
And, thank you.
And there's so much power in the way that you structure the story. And you do, you know, the jump cuts really work.
Yeah.
I think they do bring
the aesthetic.
The aesthetic.
And the moments are like, ah. And when you have your like highs and lows in the process.
Yeah.
I think it's human.
Thank you.
And it's very honest.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I admired. Like, I think, I remember the first thing I ever saw was… Reham, so I got to give her credit for that. One of our friends. She sent me, I think it was the Vimto Wings video that you did. And it was just the video, the storytelling, everything about it was great. And then I sent it to Reham. I'm like, yo, this format, this, it's like everything about this video, the storytelling, the shots, the way it's edited, the voiceovers, the whole thing. I'm like, this is it. This guy's got it, you know?
Thanks, man.
And that's what I started following. And then I went back.
Then you go through the doom scroll of like,
you know, and I kind of just went through everything that you created as far as I can go back. I'm like, okay, I get it. Like, I understand this guy.
For sure. And I definitely didn't invent that format. Like, for me, like, the creative process, you're taking inspiration from things that exist and you're kind of amalgamating into kind of remix, right? Like my dad used to always say, like, there's no such thing as new ideas, just old, new ways of telling old ones, right?
Yeah.
So like, my process is our process. And like for me, like me putting it out there, like I hope some young gun is like, okay, cool, this structure makes sense to me.
Yeah.
Like remixes it in a way that reinvents it and makes it relevant to a whole new generation. But like, that's the goal. You know, we're all on the same team, in my opinion. We're all trying to tell the stories of our cultures in a way that feels hard.
Yeah.
And like for me, if a format makes sense, I hope people adopt it and like do it within their kind of environment that makes sense to them.
Yeah.
But just to go back to your point, like it made me realize like, a lot of people, one of the criticisms of the videos that I get is like, one is like food isn't political, which jars me a lot.
Whoa. Okay, but like we'll get back. We'll get to that.
That's a triggering one.
I've got something to say about that.
We'll mix it up.
Yeah. But so that, what is the other criticism?
The other one is that like, a lot of people say that I think too deeply about issues of identity and like history, et cetera. And like, and I take contention to that, bro. Like,
fair.
I was having a conversation just literally an hour ago. I was thinking, identity and history is so important to me because I just had this mad thought the other day. I was thinking, oh my God, like I am probably the first person on both sides of my family, maternal and paternal, who has the luxury to be doing what he needs or wants to do as opposed to doing what he needs to do.
Absolutely. Amen.
And like, bro, like that thought just like blew my mind in a sense that I think of all the ancestral sacrifice. I think about the immigration. I think about the fleeing of war. I think about what my ancestors on both sides had to do for me to arrive at where I am at right now.
Yo.
I'm like, damn, the least I can do is pay homage to that history.
Yeah.
Understand that history. Like that is the least I can do. And I take inspiration in that. And
also making it, credit to you, making it digestible and easy for an average Joe Ahmed Abdullah Merriam to understand.
Yeah.
You know? That's part of disseminating the message and the knowledge.
Yeah. And it is deep. Look, there's a big difference between like, you know, I had another meeting recently and someone was saying some really validating things to me, someone who I really look up to, like a mentor. And he was telling me how, look, there's a big difference between a plate of food being in front of you and you eating it and being like, what am I tasting? Tamarind, tasting cardamom, I'm tasting these interesting flavors and telling your audience that, right?
Yeah.
There's a big difference between that, between getting a plate of food and being like, oh, this is how it makes me feel.
Right.
This is how, like, and reflecting about the significance of that food. And, you know, this is a very easy thing to relay. But like there are very few people in the world who can actually reflect on what's being had in front of them in a way that is meaningful and substantial and is related to the world that we find ourselves today in. So I think more young people need to be doing that.
I agree completely.
Reflecting about the food that we eat, its importance, how it pertains to our histories and our legacies. And I think the world would be a better place for it.
Absolutely. And so like to get to tackle the points, because I want to have difficult conversations whenever we can.
Yes.
Number one, food is absolutely political.
Very 100%. Political.
And for you to think otherwise is, it's a disservice to what to the work that's being done to A, put food on the table. So one of the things, olive oil, right?
Mm-hmm.
From seed to your plate is 25 years. Like,
crazy.
Think about it, right?
Yeah.
The thing has to grow.
Yeah.
So people plant olive trees with the knowledge they'll probably never, their sons will, their daughters will taste
so
it, right?
It won't if you be in think their
about,
lifetime.
So for me, when I sit and think about the olive tree, the olive branch,
political.
The olive grove, and how political that is.
Mm-hmm.
No, we have to tackle that.
Mm-hmm.
And we have to be respectful about it.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do it in the manner that you do, the Brown Bourdain way, I think that it has to be palatable, right? Figuratively and proverbially and literally, right? It has to be palatable.
That's the creativity.
Yeah.
That's where the creativity comes in.
100%. And that's the onus is on you. The onus is on us to actually make that accessible. And the one thing, our history is housed in the food.
Oh, man.
It is.
You know, so much of Iraq is lost. So much of Iraq is lost. But in Masgouf, I can tell you where I'm from. So like now we can play, you know. People will say Masgouf is the food of freedom because that all over the world, Iraqis everywhere bring Masgouf to the table and that fish is free, though we may be chained in so many ways. So if you
beautiful.
Think about it, right? So like food is absolutely political. It has to be. I want it to be, you know, lest we forget how we got here.
Exactly.
You know, and then
very political.
The second point, like to why should we go so deep into identity? Is it really that deep, bro? Like,
yes.
Is it really that deep?
Oh my
yes.
God.
It is.
It absolutely is, because what, and this is my own opinion, not the views of the Ken or Nader, but this is my own opinion, and I will die on this hill. If we want to numb ourselves, that Novocaine that you decide to take to, if you don't want to tackle your identity, whether you like it or not, your body keeps score, your spirit keeps score, and it will come out at some point in some strange tension. You might call it a midlife crisis. You might call it an anxiety or depression or whatever. Know thyself. Mm-hmm. To know thyself, we have to tackle our identity as diaspora, as men, mm-hmm. as women, as trans people, as anything, right?
Right.
But more importantly, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
What are you made of?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like what, who are we? So if you don't want to have that conversation and you want to have hummus, all right, cool. But one day it will rise. It rises to the surface 100%. And you will have to tackle it in your own way.
Yeah.
The great thing is we now have tools. They are blunt. They are inadequate. But we have more tools than we had before. To not look at our identity is a tragic shame.
Oh, for sure.
Because the adventure, the Can was an exploration of our identity.
Mm.
And the adventure that we've been on, because we decided to come to the table every day, every week, has been remarkable.
Yeah.
And that adventure internal is identity politics, mm-hmm. right? And DJ Khaled says it. They don't want you. They don't want you
to win.
They don't want you to win. So
I love
if you
how you
don't,
just drop a wisdom bomb. Wisdom bomb.
And then that guy.
DJ Khaled.
Yeah, yeah.
As if he's some sheikh or something.
No, exactly.
Like,
and the great DJ Khaled says, no, and I thought about that. And I'm like, no, actually they don't. If we don't talk about it, they don't want us to talk about it. If we don't talk about it, we lose more of ourselves than anyone else, right?
Yeah, 100%. And if you think like, you know, just to get even more hip, I love that. I love that language as well, man. It makes sense to me. Like, you are what you eat. And like, to get even more hippie about it, if you think as food as a life force, right?
Yes.
As one of the core necessities of human existence, then you are literally what you eat. It reminded me of the story of this Vietnamese farmer that I met in LA during this filming that we were doing around also alternative cultures of California. And she was telling me during the Vietnamese War, when her mother fled, she just left with a hemp bag of seeds.
Yes. Oh,
there it is.
Right?
See, there it is, right?
There it is.
And there
like,
it is.
And like, what does it symbolize and represent? It was like, these are things that were grown and fertilized on their homeland.
Yeah.
And what was of the most core importance to her was some sort of memory or memento or opportunity to recreate that land somewhere else with a bit more hope. And like, that's when we talk what significance of food means to people.
Of course.
It's that deep.
And like for me, like even just thinking of this little packet of seeds, like people who've had to leave Palestine, for example, the olive groves mean they take. And I knew I had the privilege of you know, people who had groves that they've taken like from Palestine to grow, you know, a homeland where, you know, the hemp bag that, you know, she has the audacity of hope in it. The audacity to believe that you will survive,
right?
That your children will live long enough to experience your Vietnam.
Exactly.
And it's so brazen and beautiful. That's the revolution I love. Like when I see and that, I'm like, tell me,
100%.
Tell me food's not political, my guy.
Exactly. How dare you?
How dare you
say
think,
it's not political or even think that?
Yeah.
When you see and hear stories like that around the world, because it says, it expresses so much in that one simple plate of food. It doesn't have to be complicated food. It could be the simplest thing. But like, there's so much that is being told in that experience. And this is what's amazing about the work that you do, is because you're walking people through not just this is what it is and this is how it's done and how it's made, but here's the colonial history.
Yeah.
Let me tell you what happened.
Need to know.
And let me tell you where the issues were. And like that, taking us through that journey kind of just like, you know, is a mind-blowing moment. But also, not only do I understand the politic of it, it gives you a much deeper respect to the food, right?
Yes.
And the people you interact with. And this was the beauty of it. Like, when we started the show, it was about the journey of figuring out this question of identity. And I think as brown and black people and third culture kids, like, that's a piece that we always trying to navigate through and figure out. And, you know, I've been through all kinds of journeys with my Sudanese identity and the issues within that. And we're politicized. The day you're born, you are politicized, whether you like it or not. So now you either choose to navigate it or pretend it doesn't exist. That becomes your choice.
But it's your way too. Yeah, it's your way too. Like, I respect someone who doesn't want to face it.
But we chose, no, we're going to tackle it every week, every day at this table. And we're going to do it in the most peaceful way, because as we always, we say in Dukan, is like, we're here to export our culture to the world. I'm here to tell the world about who we are and prove that people like us do exist.
Right.
But I totally understand that. Like, and thanks for sharing. That's beautiful, because it reminded me of, like, you know, you know what's interesting about our parallel experiences is that I grew up in the West, in London, being a minority, multicultural Muslim boy in London. And you guys grew up in Dubai, which is, of course, again, Dubai has its own unique environment. And like, these parallel experiences are happening in tandem. There's a lot that we can relate to, but there's also differences in detail, right?
Yeah.
And I think, like, growing up, a large part of what I'm hearing from what you're saying in your experience also was there was something growing up, and I remember feeling like, a lot of our narrative and our identity as minorities in the UK was so shaped by trauma, so shaped by these colonial experiences, that we didn't know who we were outside of this resistance.
Right.
Right? The resistance had become part of who we are.
Right.
Right?
Yes.
So when you have this magnet that's drawing in all your emotional energy, you cannot cultivate a personality, an identity outside of this colonial experience.
This tension. Mm-hmm. So exactly. You're sitting in the you're actually straddling that tension,
right?
Yeah. Not belonging, you know, forever in conquest of something you have no idea what you're in conquest. Who owns it? Who owns you?
100%.
Right.
And I used to ask myself, like, who are you outside of that relationship, right?
Yeah.
And I struggled.
Yeah.
Like, I needed I needed that colonial experience to shape who I was. Otherwise, I had no idea who I was outside of that. And a large part of what I need for my identity today is to understand my cultures in a way that is celebrating their excellence, their marvel, the way that they really emotionally move me, my filial relationships. These are things that give a person meaning and substance and a hope to build towards, right?
Yeah.
I don't want my children to be burdened by feelings of, like, you know, feeling that the most important thing about their history was how they were occupied by some external force, and you know, feeling inferior to something or someone. I want them to feel like, you know, emboldened by, like, how amazing these cultures they have are. And I think part of this storyteller's responsibility, and every culture has some form of traditional indigenous storytelling, whether it's West Africa and the griot tradition, or whether it's like Qawwali in South India, like, storytelling is a core component, Hikaya in Arabic, right? Like, the storyteller's role is to embolden a generation of people to feel proud and to feel like they come from something of depth and substance, because that will give them the strength to persevere despite whatever obstacles or challenges they have in the future. And, like, we are the storytellers of now, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like, content creation might sound like a very narcissistic space, and it is, don't get me wrong. Oh my God.
Yeah, like, I was going to say, like, it is.
It's full of prank videos and full of, like, stuff, which we also like, which is not to throw shade to it. It has a space. But, like, my challenge today that I'm dealing with myself, and I accept that I have narcissistic qualities as well. We all do. It's part of the human experience. How do I leverage that need for me to be, my work to be validated and to be seen by others into things of meaning is this kind of storytelling. I was like, you know, if I want to be known for anything, then I want to be known for inspiring a generation of people to feel proud about who they are.
Yeah.
And, like, that is what I feel is the responsibility of the storyteller today, culturally, and the role that they play in making us people who are living outside of our countries of heritage as diaspora to feel rooted in a sense of who we are, but not like a weight. Like,
no.
People are like, oh, you talk about identity or stuff. I'm like, yeah, I don't talk about identity because, like, I'm trying to live in Yemen back in, like, X year. I'm trying to get people rooted in an understanding so we're brave enough to build something new.
Absolutely. Yes.
There's
Absolutely.
A reason why, like, all of us being from different countries resonate with each other.
Yeah.
Because there's, like, a pan-diaspora experience that is relatable.
That is. That's very relatable. And I think also very necessary. It needs to be brought into light. Because I think To recognize that you're part of, like, diaspora means that you are displaced. Yeah. In essence, you have to reckon with the fact that you are displaced. And so for the listeners who don't know, is your background Yemeni?
Mixed.
We should give the third culture, like,
the third culture mix. I'm the only, like, Sudani on both parents. You're both mixes.
Yeah, yeah.
Yo, Iraqi, I got one.
Yeah, I'm Iraqi Filipino.
Dope.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And so I'm Yemeni, yes. Indonesian, Kenyan, Pakistani.
Yemeni, Indonesian, Kenyan, Pakistani. Dope.
So like, yeah, new generation, X-Men, mutants.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I get it. And like, the future is beige to me. Yeah.
It is.
You know what I mean? Like, that's the way it is.
There was actually a South Park episode.
Yeah. I have like a vague memory. Like,
it's like they predicted in the future in like 50 years time that the whole world's population would just be beige.
Yeah.
Because everyone eventually would
decide to mix. I'm so down.
I'm here for it.
I'm so down.
Yeah.
But no, so growing up, that mix actually for me was very difficult.
Yeah.
Yearning for like a sense of belonging in one of these places. I wasn't Arab enough to be Arab. I wasn't African enough to be African.
Yeah.
And like for me, when I was younger, in my teens especially, I was desperately just needed to be validated by one of these experiences. And I grew up and I started to realize very slowly that actually it was a superpower.
It is a superpower.
Yes.
I had access, I had exposure to so much, and it really kind of shaped my work and life, and I'm very grateful for it.
Mm.
I do believe it's going to become more and more of the human experience as time goes by.
I think so.
And we need to articulate what this experience is.
Yes. And the interesting thing is that the more people I meet who are just, you know, hyphenated hybrids, whichever way you want to refer to it, the end is always acceptance. Mm. So far, yes, there's always tension. There's the identity question. But then once you sit at my table, we come to acceptance. Mm-hmm. We come to like a really deep acceptance that the fence is actually, sitting on the fence is actually where we always wanted to be.
Yes.
Yeah.
It wasn't a prison, a narrow, long prison. No, but it's actually beauty. Where you were meant to be the whole time.
Yeah. And I think once you reach acceptance, the journey is like just beginning. You know, like
the world responds to you differently.
Yeah,
I think like when you kind of came to terms, and it's a very gradual thing. It's not like suddenly one day you wake up and you're like, dope, mm-hmm. I get who I am. No, it's a gradual thing, and the world sort of responds to mm-hmm. you in that way. And I think you've listened. I think you've listened very deeply, like in a very deep and intimate place, you know?
But it reminds me of this quote that an amazing writer in the UK wrote, Aisha Akinbishi wrote. Sorry, pardon me. it reminds me of this great quote that Aisha Akinbishi, a great writer in the UK, wrote. And it was, an infatuation with your identity limits your identity.
100%.
And like, a big part of that I really resonated with, because it was like, look, like I don't talk about identity all the time for me to be so puritanical about what I identify as. In fact, it's the opposite. I really feel like there's a world out there to be created that is a lot more like intertwined and diverse in its experiences. And like, that is very exciting for me, but it'll be difficult. Also, one thing I want to say is that like, that's not a new thing.
No, not at all.
Right? Like, cultural mixes are a thing of the past. People used to do it seamlessly.
Yeah.
And I think about my mix, and people look at my mix like, wow, whoa, that's crazy.
Yeah.
But I'm actually like, no, actually, historically, if you look at it, it's very common within the Indian Ocean.
It is.
And, you know, if the poetical way I kind of identify is like a child of the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
Because this body of water has shaped the identities around coastal cultures.
Yeah.
So that's why you get like Yemenis in Pakistan and India. You get Yemenis in like East Africa, because they traveled around all the time. And it was very normal for them to like assimilate and become part of the coastal culture there. So for me, it's about tapping into that history and that legacy of when a time where we weren't so tribal and puritanical about how we identified as. But seeing each other for the humans we are.
Yeah. And I think the notion of being coastal is very interesting because like, I always say like, I'm from the desert and the island. That's so where the horizon meets, that's where I belong, right? And that's usually where I feel the most. Like when I go to the desert or I'm in the ocean, I can, I just feel at home, at peace, or, you know, the forest is a very different place for me. 100%. I don't have that
association.
I don't know what it is, but I think that, maybe the shores, like for you, right by the shores, like, the ports, 100%. Where everything comes through, that could be the essence of you.
100%. And like, even like the old Swahili kingdom.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Used to be Oman, Yemen, Ethiopia, Sudan, Southern Sudan.
Eritrea.
It used to be the East Africa and the Southern Peninsula of Arabia used to be considered one part of, just because there was an ocean between them, didn't necessarily mean like,
Yeah, the lines weren't drawn the way that they're drawn today.
They were
right?
very close.
Yeah, they were very different, and how we identified was very transient and a lot more different. And I think that's magical.
I think we could
but
return
that's why
to that
today you go. But that's why, like, if you go to Zanzi today, you'll meet the Zanzi Yemenis, you'll meet the Zanzi Omanis, and the Arabs and the Indians. And, like, I think you get all those different 100%. Colors and different experiences, and they're all. They're all the same.
Exactly.
They all speak Swahili. They're all the same person.
100%. I'm actually working on a project on this right now. But like Swahili culture is a fascinating case study for how communities can come together under one hyphenated identity.
Yeah.
So like Swahili culture, like you said, absolutely. It had the Iranian, it had the South Asian, it had the Arab, and it had the African, right? But Swahili culture encompassed all of them.
Yeah.
So one person would identify as Swahili, and the Shirazi would identify as a Swahili, and the Omani would identify as a Swahili. Yeah. Very few places in the world are able to bring together such disparate communities in that kind of umbrella identity. And why was that happening specifically in this location? And a lot of socio-historical context, etc. But you juxtapose that with America, where everything is incredibly racialized in a very black and white way.
Right. Yeah.
And it's a very different Western-Eastern way of how we identify with race. There's lots of conversations right now around like Afro-Arab identity.
Yeah.
What does that mean? And a lot of us are kind of absorbing what we've learned from the West and the civil rights movement there and trying to place it in a place like East Africa.
So juxtaposed, when you juxtapose the layer of like the civil rights movement on East Africa from an outsider. So I'm not, you know, I find it very... It's bound to create tension because the fabric 100%. Doesn't fit.
100%.
But how do you guys feel? Like, how do you guys feel when you navigate these questions?
It's a strange one because, like, for example, for me in my teens, and this is part of the quest of identity, was that I found assimilation there and I found an understanding and a sense of expression and activism in a way that I didn't necessarily identify with because... My experience is different from you guys. I'm not mixed, right? So I'm just Sudanese, but as somebody that was basically raised outside of Sudan. So my reference was the family vacations that we take back home. So you're never Sudanese enough in Sudan. Doesn't matter what you do. There's a term for it, awlad al-mukhtaribin, like you're the ones that left, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then here, you're not Emirati, you're not Arab, you're black, right? But in Sudan, they say they're Arabs. My grandmother was like, no, we're not Africans, we're Arabs. Like that, may she rest in peace. Like that's what she used to say. So I'm like, but grandma, no, you think that here, but as soon as you leave this country, people see you differently. That's not the case. That's not what people are saying about us, you know? And my experience said differently. So this tension is something I've always had. And I've expressed that on the show many times. Now, dealing with like racial clashes here as a kid and not having a reference because in Sudan, the issues were You study the history, it's a colonial history. And yes, there were racial issues, but Sudan had a role to play in like Arab slavery trade and it had different roles that it played. So then, but why are we doing that if we're the black people? We're doing it to other black guys. So like a lot of these wouldn't click. Like it's just too many points not connecting. And I was just super confused about it. But then the American Civil Rights Movement, then coming to discovering these books, studying, you know, reading, it began with Malcolm X's book, right? And then it went to... your Martin Luther King's. And then one of the best books I ever read was Jamal Joseph. And that opened my eyes to the Black Panther movement and the history of the Black Panther. And then...
So just as a question, sorry to interrupt, because I think that some of the people listening may not necessarily understand, you know, all of the references. What are the pillars of the conversation? What is the tension right now? What is the Afro-Arab tension, modern-day tension?
The modern day tension is a rejection from the Arab world, like you're not Arab, but then...
From the Arab world?
Yeah.
Like, so the Arab world says that you're not Arab?
No, like you're an Afro-Arab in the sense of, you speak Arabic, but you're not Arab. You're still black, you're still African. You and the rest of the African continent, you're all colored or painted in the same brush.
So your blackness excludes you or your Africanness excludes you from being Arab.
Completely,
okay, and then on the other side?
And then on the other side, in Sudan, we are Arabs, but that's the post-colonial issues that Sudan has dealt with.
Okay.
Right? So that tension in itself is a big issue of the identity. So then reading all these books suddenly now became like young black activists grew a fro in high school and like it was a whole situation, right? And that became part of my expression because now I'm starting to see the racial layers.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was always exposed to it. And as a kid, everybody feels the same. But then once you start seeing these racial layers, or once you get put in a position where you have to face it at a very young age in a way that an average person would not face it, you start to see the things differently.
Absolutely. And like, such an important conversation to have. And I think like what I'm learning, hearing through your experience, or the question I'm asking myself is like, these are two different paradigms of how we approach race entirely differently, right? Like the West deals with it because of its historical, socio-political context specifically in its way. And like the Middle East has its own way. But like, what's weird to me is that Black and Arab aren't two opposite ends of the spectrum.
Correct.
That's what I was trying to get to.
It's not supposed to be.
They're two different misnomers, you know? Right?
Yeah.
Like, and Black as a construct of whiteness, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, really, my dad always used to say he was only considered Black when he left Africa, right? So if we accept Blackness as a creation of whiteness, then how does it apply in context that Blackness was really never really considered a thing, or wasn't called that specifically? And when you think about Arabness, I also think about like, you know, people who might be perceived as Black within Arab nations such as Saudi Arabia and Yemen,
mm-hmm.
where you have like old families that have like original ancestries within like even Nigeria and,
yep.
And African Peninsula. But they're part of the Arab fabric.
Experience. Yeah, yeah, they're part of the Arab world,
exactly.
Period.
And then what does it mean to be Arab in that context? And what does Arab actually mean?
Well, what does it mean to be Arab is the question of my life.
Yeah. Like, it's such I find solace in it being like such a broad concept that like it encompasses so many experiences and sorry, you
no, completely. It does, because this is some Safia Al-Hilo she's a Sudanese poet based at, Sudanese American poet in New York, and she actually wrote an interesting piece on this from her research, and she used a term which was a new term for me that I've never heard before, Arabophone. So she calls Sudanese people Arabophone, which means that you speak the language, you understand it, but that doesn't make you an Arab. You're still Black and African.
Hmm.
And I've never heard this term before, Arabophone.
Like Anglophone?
Like, correct.
Like Anglophone.
Like, kind of like Anglophone, right?
I'm interested. I clearly don't know enough.
So she's differentiating between the ethnicity of an Arab and someone who linguistically can speak.
Yes. Correct.
For me growing up, I always understood them as, to be Arab meant that you spoke the language of Arabic.
Mm.
That's what I also understood as Arab, right?
So, like, sorry, go ahead.
For me, like, I would take a challenge with that, because I would say that it's a weird racialized way of viewing like what an Arab is, right? For me, like, I mean, my whole identity as an Arab is predicated on the fact that it was a community of people of different ethnic DNA,
right,
brought together under the umbrella of Arabness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was really inspiring for me as a youngster, that you can be Sudani on one end and you can be like a Syrian with blue eyes and like super fair skin
on the other end.
And
exactly.
Still considered as an Arab person.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like I need to have that for my sense of positive association with Arabness, because that's what really I found inspiring growing up in the West, was like the way that we identify in the West is entirely different, right?
Completely.
And Middle East, we had this example of being able to be one thing, which encompasses
across
multitude of experiences.
22 different countries. That's the argument, that this was, when you take the countries that found there, the Arab League, they're 22.
Yeah.
Right?
But where it becomes different and real is that colorism is real.
Yes.
And like, forgetting that would be negating an experience that people across the region feel. And part of me is torn between whether this is a modern concept of like colorism within Arab communities being, is it a modern thing that we've kind of adopted from like colonial kind of experiences, or is it part of the historical legacy that we have to address? And to be honest, even my own research with my own like East African family, these are tough questions I've had to ask myself.
Yeah.
For example,
where did that take you?
Well, just to share with you vulnerably, like I've been trying to do a series in East Africa for now. I'm actually working on it. And it means like opening the door on some of the family history that I'm not necessarily proud of.
Yeah.
And part of that untangling is part of that experience, right?
Yeah.
For example, you know, my Swahili family are very mixed. And some of us are dark skinned, some of us are a lot lighter. And there have been grandmothers within that ancestral line that were local indigenous African women.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But we don't hear about that ancestral legacy. We talk about the Yemeniness, very proud of the Yemeniness, the Arab legacy, and it's a very Hadhrami kind of Swahili experience, etc. But then where's the Giriyama? Where
did
indigenous
it go?
African, exactly.
Yeah, like, and who erased it? Like,
exactly.
And so when you look at identity politics, you have to look at why, what was erased. First of all, identify the erasure. who erased it?
Exactly.
And why wasn't it revived? Who fought for it?
And what does it say about the context, right?
Exactly.
Because I'm assuming, you know, talking with my family, etc., to be Arab in that East African context was seen as a status symbol.
Right.
So even if you were indigenous East African, you wanted to marry within an Arab family and become an Arab because why? It gave you more luxuries in life in general. Yeah. It gave you status. It gave you position.
It was transactional in many ways, right?
Mm. Well, is that transactional? But if someone feels like they are less, and want to marry into something that they feel is more, it's sad. It's a sad transaction.
It is.
Because she doesn't realize what she's leaving behind. Well, now me, I have the luxury of being like,
an anthropologist, like
exactly,
going
like,
through.
Like, oh, why did you let that go? But back then, that's how it was. And then things were done. But like, there are legacies within my own ancestral experience in which we didn't even talk about. And me and my dad would, et cetera, but extended family, et cetera, it would be hard to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Of course.
Because it means that we have to accept the dark elements of our own histories.
Right.
But what could be more fruitful and what could be more beautiful than like addressing these with sincerity and compassion? I think the opposite is terrible. I mean, the opposite being neglecting, ignoring, and not addressing issues. And I just felt insincere. I felt insincere about talking these issues without really addressing where like my own family have been inadequate in it.
Completely. And, and I know exactly where I completely understand that feeling because there are some very dark parts of my family history.
Everyone's family history. I don't imagine anybody's hands. No one's hands are clean, my friend. So, right? Like, it's not.
And like, colorism is real. Like,
yeah.
And curious to understand, like, in part of your quest was, because my understanding, at least in Sudan, is that this is a post-colonial thing that came about. Prior to that, that wasn't, I guess, the Sudanese zeitgeist or the norm to have these issues. We were tribalists, yes.
Exactly.
They're tribes. Mm. But the colorism part of it, or the pride in Arabness versus Africanness, was not, you know, it wasn't part of the conversation until that began with the colonial history of the nation.
I mean, like, from what I have understood, and, you know, I'm not the kind of guy that believes that colonialism, we have to blame everything on colonialism, because there's some stuff we also have to like take into consideration for ourselves. But colonialism did really F things up in the region. Like, I think what the colonials found it really hard to do, and their cliche tactic was divide and conquer, right? You pit tribes against each other. But then they came into this Islamic context where people identified under this spiritual tradition across different ethnicities, and they found it very difficult.
Yeah.
So what they started to do was break down the Islamic and started dividing people amongst like ethnic lines.
So
they came to Zanzibar, etc. They gave the Shirazi, the Iranians, and Arab Omanis certain privileges, and they excluded the Black African and other people certain privileges.
Yeah.
So what you do, you create division within context in which division didn't occur in the first place. So like, that is people have to accept that is part of the legacy of colonialism, is dividing people who traditionally weren't divided along those lines.
Yes.
Right? And a lot of us have inherited that as part of our experiences today. But you know, maybe that this is why history is super important, because we do have a reference for when things were entirely different.
Yeah.
And why we can't compare like Western ideas of race and identity, because it just doesn't fit in our context.
No. Yeah.
It's a completely different paradigm. And like, when people want to use language that's appropriate in like a Western sense, it doesn't fit in the Eastern. For example, even when we say slavery, right? Slavery is a huge term, right? Like, when we think slavery, our natural instinct takes us to like the Atlantic slave trade, of course, because it was the biggest, most tragic reference we have in human history. But the Indian Ocean slave trade was a completely different texture and how it operated, right? Yes, we were complicit in like the transaction of slavery, but so was most of the world in that context, right? And yes, it was black on black a lot of the time as well.
Yeah.
But when I look at Swahili culture, the difference there, which my teacher told me, was that even within Swahili culture, the Black African had the mobility to rise from being, he was African, but he was also considered Swahili. Mm. And he could be in positions of power.
Yeah.
He could have business. He could do, there was mobility amongst the social hierarchy.
Right.
Whereas in an American context,
no,
there was no mobility.
Yeah.
You were who you were a slave. And there was a deterioration of the human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You were seen as, you were dehumanized.
Yeah.
Your basic civil rights, your identity was stripped away from you.
Yeah.
And like, that is a completely different form of oppression than what occurred in the East. Yeah. Of course, on the East Coast, like of Africa, was it tragic? Of course, it was slavery, of course. But how it manifested was entirely different in terms of texture and substance. The Atlantic slave trade was dehumanizing, but the Indian Ocean had its own complexities, which made it very different in detail.
And that's so true. what I'm so fascinated by, and I want to grow old with you because I want to see that your body of work is going to be your thesis, mm-hmm. in essence, right? It is going to be your thesis for what is this identity? Who are you? Who are we? And so the exploration, I guess, I'm seeing this amongst my peers. We're exploring the pre-colonial experience because we want to know a world different than the one we know now.
Right.
It's happening in Philippines. There's an amazing movement. And I see it. I hope one day I'll tap into Iraq's, like, you know, there's so much pre-colonially that we have to explore. I'm fascinated that you're doing this through the medium, through the Trojan horse that is your work. And I cannot wait. I cannot wait to see what you uncover. What is where are you now, like, in the journey? Where are you now, and where do you hope this whole thing is going to go? Because it's deep and wide, right?
It is.
Like, it's not just…
100%. Like, a lot of this sounds heavy, but I also just love living life and having a good time and community also. And offline experience is a big part of what I do. But where I want this to go is ultimately, very, very materialistically, the Netflix series is like my dream kind of goal to get to at some point.
Call it to existence.
And also writing, I enjoy that. And like for me, it's about finding other means of telling these kind of stories on a larger scale so more people have access to it. So when we talk about educating a whole global audience about the complexities that we've kind of touched on today, for me, my creative inspiration is being like, all right, cool. Like, how can we make more people understand this?
Right.
Like, the person who lives in like Ohio, America, how can he have a deep understanding of the differences between like the slavery that took place in East Africa versus the Atlantic trade, slave trade? And that for me is very exciting. It's like, every creative has a problem premise that they're trying to address.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And for me, educating the world to make them more understanding and empathetic towards one another is my creative inspiration. So the Netflix series, pray for me.
It's happening. Hey, it's happening. Happen. It's already happened,
manifesting
in my opinion.
It, manifesting that. And like, that would be endgame for me. But offline, in terms of how I want to live my life, like, I love bringing people together.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Community is a big part of what I do. And I'm very lucky because I consider Dubai a home. I consider Jakarta a home. I consider like New York a home, and LA. A big part of me just wants to live a life that is like, kind of sounds very like first world problems. But a large part of my life is like traveling between these places, cultivating a sense of community
and
like togetherness, and just building a world that like full of people that I want to be around and grow old with. And whatever those experiences looks like, it might be food related, it might be experience. But I love doing those. And those are really special.
Yeah,
like,
I get
that. We've forgotten how to be offline with one another these days, right?
Well, the great thing is we haven't, but I think people have. Yeah. And we should revive that. Yeah. Being offline is not only critical to our existence, but if you want to live a long life, it is the tenet of longevity. It's a tenet of longevity to have like real human deep connections. That's part of living a wonderful and long life.
And also last but not least, like a family at some point.
Yeah, of course.
And like that's real.
Course.
That's real. Yeah. I think we get so lost in the hustle, but like the greatest project I'll ever work on is my family.
Yeah. Mm.
And like, I'm really excited about that prospect as well. And like, if anything, it can only inform and elevate my work.
Of course.
And I think coming from a really strong family that is a source of inspiration for me, I get excited about what that future might hold for me as well. And like, I feel like we should talk about more of that stuff, because life isn't just hustle, work, and like what we're going to be doing, but it's also about the bedrock of community is family. And if our work is like celebrating community, then we should be celebrating family as well, and like creation of that. So big aspiration.
I love it. Speaking of family and food and all these good stuff.
Here we go.
Community. Alrighty, Reams, we're ready with the Shataf report.
But before we get into it.
The Shataf report?
Question mark. God's work.
I love it. This is it.
Did I just hear Shataf report?
You did, sir.
Explain.
Is it self-explanatory?
I mean…
It is a long sign… not long, but it is an official… Officially, it's a new tradition of the Dukan Show. Thanks to Reem and her service for the public.
God's work. God's work.
It's cleaning up other people's shit.
At all times.
So, pretty much what we do is that Reem experiences different toilets around the world.
What a great job. I love that for you.
Investigative journalism. Oh my God.
We are here talking about… Girl, you should be like…
We're talking about culture.
Forget pre-colonial identity politics. The Shataf is where it's at. Forget all the
pre
things
we've spoken
about.
Pre and post-colonial toilets.
Damn. What are you talking about?
This is
everything
what this is.
No, this is just about cleanliness. Like the standard.
A whole generation of young people wanting to be like Shataf reporters.
You know? Yeah. Oh, Shataf reporters. It's a movement.
What is it? Cleanliness.
Get it? It's a movement. Did you not even hear the…
No, I missed it. Because I was trying to remember the quote.
I just got it. I like this.
Do you even clean yourselves? Anyways, continue. Please continue with this.
All right, Irim. So how do you judge? How do you judge your shataf's and the toilets?
The criteria is, number one, the shataf must exist and its construction must be fabulous. Mm. If you're one of them plastic ones that's like got the silver sparkles when it's when I use it because it's flaking, no.
Oof, lime scale.
You like and lime scale. No. The second one is pressure. If there is no pressure, you are not clean.
Yes, ma'am.
If there is no pressure, you are not clean.
But some of them got the really high pressure and
then you're being assaulted. And that there's nothing I can do to help you. So we're trying to find that middle ground between like not being clean and being assaulted. That middle ground, that's where I'm
Aren't
at.
We all?
That's where I'm at. That's where I live. Number three is the water temperature. I like a body temperature, but some people like it cold. It's hard to find a cold shataf in Dubai in the summer. I tell you that much.
But if you find one,
DM me. Let me know. Auntie Reem on Instagram. And then finally, the ambiance, the experience, and the toilet paper. We have yet to find 3-ply in this city. If you love your customers, you would pay the extra for the 3-ply. People will come. We know. I'll bring them there. Anyways.
We're ready?
Hit it. It's the
shataf. Damn.
I know. I was with Arva, Frying Pine Adventures, and we went to Kuya, ladies and gentlemen. Kuya is the modern Filipino eatery. They are putting Filipino food forward in the city. And if you go to the washroom.
Shout out to Chef JP.
Yeah. Chef JP, you know what you're doing. And here's the thing. Speaking of it, on the menu, a lot of the food is Filipino food, truthfully. I would love to take you on a Filipino food tour. We're going to do that. And then when you go into the washroom, you're going to see protruding gray tile. Everything is gray. There's plants. There's bamboo. It's a vibe. It's so cool. No. But it's right across from the kitchen. So it's like a back alley. And then you're in Narnia, right? Okay, so the bathroom is Narnia. Okay. And then
I don't know. I feel like I wanted spa music.
And this is the only gray throne that I've seen in the city. I have not seen another gray throne. It's like gray, gray, gray. It's really nice. And then there's a black shataf. It's metal.
Ooh, fancy.
Wow. It is. And it's got structure. It's got weighted. It's got budget. You know?
Premium.
They put it where it counts is the point. And then water pressure. The water pressure is fantastic. It is fantastic. You are clean. They cared. Don't turn the knob yourself, by the way. You should enter. Don't touch the knob. You should enter and it should clean you. That's how I feel about my 100%. Life in general. Not getting assaulted. Clean. Yeah. All right. Clean on all counts.
I've never wanted to shit in a restaurant.
This is it, right? I know. Again, this is the work. This is the work, you know? And then where are we? Oh, yes. The water temperature. A little bit cold. Some people like that. It's hard to find a cold shataf in Dubai. But what I do like about it is that, and some places you can't, I think you can adjust it a little bit, like the temperature. I'm not sure, but I felt like it adjusted.
Let's not get too hopeful.
Maybe I'm raising people's hopes. And finally, we have 2-ply toilet paper. The ambiance is amazing. So on the point of 2-ply toilet paper, I dock a point. But otherwise, it's a 4-star from Auntie Rain. Yes.
Big
I would love to do a Filipino kind of food experience at Kuya.
Let's
figure it out. If anybody wants to come, just DM us and we'll figure out a night. Everything there, the details are culturally correct. It's beautiful.
If it's got your stamp of approval, it must be dope.
Yeah, it's dope. It is really dope.
A lot.
Yeah. Because we didn't... I don't think Filipino food is represented well.
Yes.
And exactly. I think we this have the is the place. Worldwide. Sudanese food, you feel?
Yeah. Like, by the way, most of the Sudanese restaurants out here are like little spaces for bachelors that are away from family, away from home, live alone, and want a taste of home.
Is it because Sudanese food doesn't translate well into a culinary experience? Is it like Indonesian food is like that?
I think it either... honestly, I don't know the answer to that. In one way, I feel like there are certain things that will translate well. And I've been toying with the idea of actually getting into an F&B space specifically for single item menu. But a lot of the food... To your point, it just doesn't necessarily translate well to a culinary
experience. It's like home food.
I thought that about Filipino food until I went to Kuya. Really? Let's go together.
So that's why I feel like it can be done. It's just waiting for the right chef to unlock that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And you have to decide that this is the movement you're going to be spearheading. Mm. Because you have to have people on board to believe in the culinary ethos. Mm. Which is not necessarily, it's home food elevated. Yeah, it's a vibe. 100%. It's a vibe.
Completely.
So on that note, Kuya, it's where it's at. And that's the Shataf Report.
Yes, ma'am.
Kuya, that's the shit.
Yeah.
Nader, man, thank you so much
thank
for being
you.
With us.
Thanks for having me. Oh, man,
so
it's been a pleasure.
So happy this happened.
Like, yeah, we almost solved the world.
One would hope. I'm looking forward to growing old with you.
Yeah, so I appreciate you. So thank you for your work, guys. I appreciate it. Thanks
thank
for having
you,
me.
Thank you, man. And honestly, look, anytime you're in town, the studio's ready. We're ready. Let's just do it. And we can
do it.
Off the mic stuff. We'll go eat together.
Yeah,
discover things together.
You're stuck with me now.
Let's make it happen.
Thank God.
Forget that.
Yeah. Alrighty, y'all. Thank you for tuning in to this week's episode of The Can Show. We'll see you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for kicking it with us today. I hope you enjoyed listening to this week's episode as much as we enjoyed creating it for you. Please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcast at to stay up to date with all our conversations. Also, if you don't mind, hit us with the 5-star rating, leave a comment, let us know how you feel about the show. That way, it could also help others find the show. And be sure to share it with your friends and family, whoever you think can benefit from it. You can holler at us on all social media platforms at The Can Show. We'd love to hear from you. Or you could drop us an email to hello@thecanmedia.com. Salam.